There are many ways to understand the benefits or goals of spiritual practice. We might understand the benefit as being union with God, wholeness, healing, authenticity, ultimate nature, wakefulness, peace, joy, liberation. And even within the Buddhist tradition and the Buddhist teachings, there are many ways of understanding the development of practice, the development of the five spiritual faculties, the walking of the Noble Eightfold Path, the cultivation and maturation of the ten paramis, seven factors of enlightenment. So it can be a little challenging to answer for ourselves, what are we doing here? How can we understand what we're doing here this week in a way that incorporates our experience but inspires us to continue or to lead us on to really understand or to seek the fulfillment of what the Buddha realized? And there's one teaching that the Buddha offered that encompasses all that I've just mentioned. And this is the teachings on the Four Noble Truths. There's a story from the time of the Buddha where the Buddha saw that someone needed or wanted or was ripe for hearing the Dharma. And so he sent his right-hand man, Sariputra, to give a discourse to this person to speak about the Dharma. So Sariputra went and spoke to this person and, you know, shared the Dharma with him and came back and told the Buddha what he'd done. And the Buddha said, "Oh, that's too bad." He said, "Because if you had spoken about the Four Noble Truths, that person would have gotten enlightened." Thereafter, Sariputra always included the Four Noble Truths in his teachings. So just in case there's anyone here who's ripe for hearing and opening, I'm not going to let the retreat go by without speaking about the Four Noble Truths. So tonight, here we go. The Four Noble Truths are the first discourse that the Buddha gave after his awakening or realization. And it is the kind of the bedrock. It's like the essential Dharma, if you will. It is the foundation upon which all the Buddhist traditions rest. While there may be tremendous difference between the appearance and the practices and even the teachings of Tibetan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism and Burmese Buddhism, they all have within them the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. So, what are the Four Noble Truths? Now, I know most of you have heard teachings on the Four Noble Truths, so I don't really want to bore you with the obvious. So, we'll just cut to the chase. So what are the teachings on the Four Noble Truths? What is the First Noble Truth? Well, the First Noble Truth is the truth of dukkha. Now, dukkha is one of those words that I mentioned this morning in Pali that is better left untranslated, or is best left not trying to translate it simply as a single word or even a phrase, because to really understand what the word dukkha means is at least a full discourse, if not more. So let me be brief. I'll only give it a half hour. When I first started practicing the Dharma 30 years ago, a little more than 30 years ago, I heard the First Noble Truth translated as life is suffering. Well, that wasn't a very inviting entree to the Buddhist teachings. And it wasn't until 10 years later when I went to Burma, finally, that I heard one of Sayadaw Upandita's translators use the word oppressive to indicate the meaning of dukkha. Well, by that point, I could get it. Oppressive, okay, I think I know what that means. Suffering, that was too heavy. That was too much. My life wasn't suffering. I didn't get it. But oppressive, I could open to that. So what does dukkha really mean? Well, the most obvious meaning of dukkha is pain. Physical pain, mental or emotional pain. It is the obvious pain that we all experience. You know, there's the pain of getting sick, having a headache, feeling hungry. There's the pain of disease, having some temporary disease or a lingering disease. There's just a lot of physical discomfort and aches and sharpness, and it's tormenting and it's unpleasant physical pain. There's also the obvious mental pain. There's the pain of frustration, disappointment, feeling alienated, feeling alone, feeling lonely, feeling discriminated against, feeling sad, feeling incompetent, feeling ineffective in your intentions and actions, feeling abandoned. There's just a tremendous range of mental or emotional pain that we all experience at some point. And the truth of dukkha, the First Noble Truth, is just a statement of this kind of pain is a fact in life. It's a fact. It is so obvious to each one of us, if we are honest in our life, that there's pain in our life, physical and mental, that this kind of dukkha is called dukkha-dukkha. But there's another meaning to the word dukkha which we need to begin to open to. And it has something to do with the fact that everything changes. And because everything changes, it means that the conditions which we enjoy in life are unstable. They change. They change at their own timing, not when necessarily when we want them to. And so even though we may currently be experiencing a bountiful life with good health and plenty of resources and lots of friends, in a stable economy, and all that can change. Not because we do anything wrong, not because it's our fault, not because we're incompetent, but just because things are unstable. Things change, you know, in their own time. And so we are forever living with this knowledge of how insecure the conditions of our life really are. Now, we have spent our lives pursuing and acquiring the conditions, knowledge and relationships and finances and whatever, careers and stuff in life, to provide for our security. And we do that. And yet somewhere just on the periphery of our awareness is this truth that it is all unstable. And so it's a kind of a niggling insecurity that we live with. Well, most of us kind of take it personally. You know, it's my insecurity. It's just me. I haven't gotten it together yet. I haven't quite put enough aside for the rainy day, and I haven't quite got, you know, my act together here and there. And it's, we take it personally, that the insecurity that I feel is personal. But it's not. It's universal. Everyone lives with this level of insecurity. You know, we look at others and we think, oh, they've really got it together. They got a better this, a nicer that, a more, you know, healthier and more money and better retirement and whatever. And we think they really got it together. Well, yeah, maybe. And they still live with this same level of insecurity or same kind of insecurity. So this is one of the challenges of the Buddha's realization, is that when we personalize our pain, our insecurity, we actually, while we may acknowledge it, we're actually missing the significance of what the Buddha was teaching and pointing to, that this pain and this insecurity is universal. It is not personal. Now, when we hear this, we say, yeah, but, you know, I'm healthy and I'm feeling, you know, I enjoy life and there's a lot of good in my life and there's happiness in my life and there's, you know, some level of security. And what's wrong with that? Nothing. The Buddha didn't say avoid pleasure or avoid what levels of security you can obtain. So we might say, well, pleasure is pleasure, but hidden within pleasure is the potential for change, which is painful. Okay. You can see from obvious pain to the insecurity and vulnerability of change, it's a subtler kind of it's not okayness. But there's a third level, or a third meaning of the word dukkha, which we also need to hear about and begin to understand. And it's called sankhara dukkha. And there are two views of sankhara dukkha. There's the macro view and the micro view. And the macro view goes like this. We're born helpless. And for several years, our parents or other caregivers doing the best they can, feed us, bathe us, clean us, educate us, clothe us, coo us, love us, play with us, entertain us, do whatever they can to get us through the day, after day, after day, after day. And gradually they entrain others to help with the task, siblings and teachers and the community of one sort or another. And, you know, as we go through our years, we are gradually educated and trained to take care of ourselves. And so we reach our teenage years or somewhere around there, and gradually we discover we're on our own. And now it's up to us to take care of this body and this mind. Well, to take care of this body, first you need to bathe it every day a couple times. And you need to dress it and groom it, and you have to eat. And you have to eat several times a day, and after you eat you got to go to the bathroom. And, you know, as you grow a little older and you move out of the house, you have to buy the food that you eat. In order to buy the food, you need money. In order to get the money, you need a job. In order to get the job, you need to go to school for 16 years. And that's dukkha. So, okay. And so we got to take care of this body, and you got to do it every day. And, you know, you got to keep moving around, and because if you sit still for too long, you know what that's like? Painful. So you got to keep this body moving, and if you don't move it enough, it gets painful. But if you move it too much, you can overstrain it, and that can also be painful. So there's a delicate dance that you got to do with this body, but it's even more delicate with the mind, because here you have this mind, and you have to keep this mind happy, or it'll make you miserable. Now, you have to keep this mind happy, and so, you know, you entertain it, and you distract it, and you play with it, and you forget it, and you put it to sleep, and you drink it, you do whatever you can to kind of keep that mind happy so that it doesn't get upset, frustrated, disappointed, you know. So you got to keep pretty active engagement with this mind. Because otherwise, if you don't take care of the mind, if you don't do anything with it, it's just like being on retreat your whole life. And that's dukkha too. Okay. So, now you've got this body that you've got to take care of every day, and this mind that you've got to monitor and take care of every minute of every day. And you've got to do this for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, sometimes 9 decades. Every day. You have to do it. You can't get anybody to do it for you. You know, they got their own. And you have to do it. You have to take care of it. And at the end of all that care and attention and investment of time, energy, knowledge, and wisdom, what happens? It goes in a little box, and it goes in a hole in the ground. The end. Bad investment. And you have to do it. That is oppressive. Think about it. It's like, isn't that oppressive? It's hard to admit that it's oppressive. Why? Because we can't imagine any other alternative. What's the option? And so, to just say, life's oppressive, well, yeah, but I don't want it to be, but, well, that's dukkha. It means that it's oppressive, that it's a burdensome. That's the macro view. The micro view is we're born and we have these 5 senses and the mind. In Buddhist teachings, 6 senses. There's the eyes that see, the ears that hear, the nose that smells, the tongue that tastes, the body that feels, and the mind that thinks. And these sense doors are being constantly bombarded and stimulated 24/7. They're just constantly being impinged with sense objects. You can close your eyes and your mind will still play movies in front of you. You can close your ears and you'll hear concerts that you went to years ago. And the body, it's always feeling something. And the mind, it's just going on and on and on. It's just chattering away. It's just kind of keeping you entertained. And you can't shut it off. How are you going to do it? You can't shut it off. You have to kind of bear with this onslaught of constant stimulation. Some of it's pleasant. And some of it's really unpleasant. You don't have any choice. You have to deal with it. You have to put up with it. You can't give it away. You can't distract yourself enough to avoid it. It will find you. Wherever you go, whatever you do, you'll have to bear with it. This too is oppressive. It's just like, give me a break. Give me some relief from this constant bombardment. That is dukkha. Now, we see that dukkha has a variety of meanings. There's pain. There's the vulnerability of insecurity and changeable conditions. There's the oppressiveness of just having to deal with decades of constant stimulation. The collective term for dukkha in all these variety of meanings is it's unsatisfactory. It's just unsatisfactory to have to deal with all of this. Now, if all we're doing with this body and mind is just trying to get through with as little dukkha as possible to the end, well, good luck, and it's not a very meaningful life. But if we take the opportunity to really look at this life and really try to understand what is this all about, and you recognize the universal nature of dukkha, then you see that what you are opening to and feeling and learning how to deal with, everyone else is dealing with. Everyone else is dealing with, in one way or another, skillfully or not. And the only, or the ingredient, the single ingredient that makes life worth living as best you can is compassion. Is to live in such a way as to relieve yourself of dukkha and to help others be relieved of dukkha. However you can do that. Because we know, you look around, everyone you see has this same condition. It is such a joy, really, to be able to offer some action, some word, some behavior that relieves suffering. And that brings a real joy to the mind. Well, everyone experiences dukkha. Men have their dukkha, women have their dukkha. Young folks have their dukkha, elderly certainly have their dukkha. Those who are healthy have the dukkha of fearing what's to come, and those who are unhealthy have their obvious dukkha. Those who live in monasteries or remote, secluded places, they have their dukkha. As we who live the family life in busy metropolitan urban areas in the 21st century also have dukkha. Those who lived at the time of the Buddha experience dukkha. Those who live now experience dukkha. And those who live in the future will experience dukkha. Animals have their dukkha. Humans have their dukkha. And if you understand or believe in other realms, other, they also have their dukkha. It's universal. It's not like we're going to somehow get it together and fix our condition so that no dukkha in this relative world. Practice is said to discover dukkha. The purpose of practice is to discover, is to really investigate dukkha. And you might say, well, why would I want to do that? Well, because if you don't know that you're suffering, if you don't know that you're oppressed, if you don't know that you're feeling vulnerable, you won't do anything about it. You'll continue to live your life in ignorance and proliferating more of the same for yourself and others. So we practice, and lo and behold, we discover dukkha. It's not that practice creates dukkha. It's not that sitting causes you this pain or this vulnerability or this oppressiveness. Just sitting and paying attention reveals what is already there. Yes, of course, some posture, you're just sitting there and there's pain in the body, but it is that through the looking, we see what's going on. It's important to discover dukkha so that we can do something about it. One way we can approach practice is to understand that it is actually an act of compassion to practice because we discover our own suffering. And when we discover our own suffering, we also begin to understand how to relieve ourselves and others from suffering. And so even though you come and it's painful, it's frustrating, it's challenging, it's difficult, you know what? It's hard to practice. It's hard to open the mind. It's hard to feel the body. It's hard to acknowledge the First Noble Truth. But it is compassionate to do that, because then we can move wisely to alleviate that dukkha. Now, that's the First Noble Truth. First Noble Truth of dukkha is to be investigated. Now, I have a question for you. When you open to pain, vulnerability, suffering, oppressiveness, the unsatisfactoriness of your life, did you ever really ask yourself, why? Why do I have to experience this? Why is it like this? Well, the Buddha, in realizing the truth, asked that question, and he discovered the answer in the Second Noble Truth, or what he articulated as the Second Noble Truth. He said, this dukkha is caused by craving. Now, let's be clear. Craving is about attachment, wanting, clinging, being identified with something. It also includes the aversion of not wanting something. You know, it's that reliance on things to support our sense of self. So what is it that we want? We want things. We want knowledge. We want relationships. We want status. We want profit. We want pleasure. We want set gratification. We want health. We want long life. We want an agreeable sense of self. We want to love ourselves. We want approval. All of these wantings, the Buddha said, are the source of dukkha. Now, bear with me for a minute. As I was growing up, I was either taught or I somehow acquired this assumption that if I could just get what I want, I'll be happy. Doesn't that make sense? If I can get what I want. Don't you think that if you can get what you want, you'll be happier? That's kind of logical, isn't it? The Buddha said, wrong. If you get what you want, still dukkha. What does he mean? Well, it's clear that if you want something, any of those things or mental flavors or experiences, emotional support that I mentioned, if you want that and you can't get it, you can't buy it, you can't get it in any way, that's really suffering. But if you can get it, the Buddha was honest enough to acknowledge that there is a moment of relief, quickly followed by the fear of losing it. Or if it's of any value at all, it'll be taxed. If it's digital, it'll be outdated in 6 months. If it's alive, it is definitely going to get old eventually and get sick and die. Whatever you acquire or get or kind of own or become in order to support your happiness, your contentment, is going to change. It's vulnerable. And so the happiness that comes in dependence on it is fragile. And we know that. Somewhere just on the periphery of our awareness. Dharma practice is to bring that knowledge right in front of us all the time, so that we aren't mistaken in believing that getting, having, becoming, any of that is going to make you ultimately secure and happy. So, some of us, well, all of us, and many others, eventually find our way to the Dharma. We understand some level of, you know what, getting more, having more, becoming more isn't doing it for me. I think I'll go into practice, or something like that. And so we get into practice, and we hear the teachings, we go on retreat, and our habits come with us. So now we're in retreat, you know, and we're just trying to, you know, kind of open to dukkha. And in creeps this little thought. Geez, I'd like to have a good sitting today. I hope my retreat is a good retreat. You know, we come in and sit down, and we can't help but hope that this sitting's a little better than the last sitting, or the fourth day is a little better than the first day. And so, you know, as one of our students said, you know, there's nothing like a good sitting to ruin the rest of your day. Now, why? Because, you know, you have a good sitting. You come in, you have a good sitting, or your good first 20 minutes or something, and you're just kind of like, wow, it's effortless, it's clear, it's calm, it's open. You know, you're not just kind of tormented by thinking. And then the thought will come, now I got it. This is the way it's going to be for the rest of the sitting or the rest of the retreat. And it never is. And the next sitting you come in and your body is tied up in knots and it's painful and you can't find the breath and you can't find them. You can't be mindful and the mind's just running all over the place. And you think, what did I do wrong? You didn't do anything wrong. This is the very nature of the way it is. Things change. So even in our Dharma practice, it's hard to find relief from dukkha. Well, we crave pleasant experience, that's for sure. We like pleasant over unpleasant. The Buddha said we also crave or cling to or yearn for or, you know, want what we could say is a better future. Did you want a better future today? You know all that planning you were doing earlier today? What's that all about? Planning mind is all about laying down tracks for a better future. Right? It's like, I hope it comes out this way, not that way. And we strategize, we scheme, and we do this, we plant seeds and intentions, we talk to people and try to get it all set up so that the future is better. And when we get there, it can be nothing other than dukkha of some sort, during which we are laying down the tracks for a better future. And when we get there, it is also still dukkha. How is that ever going to end? Think about that. You know, like John Lennon says, life is what happens while you're busy making other plans. You know, we're making plans for the future, not living now. And if every future includes dukkha, from which we're making plans to get away from that dukkha, this is called samsara, looking for happiness in all the wrong places. Because it just goes around and around and around. And while there are moments of relief, the grand scheme of it all is pursuing dukkha. The Buddha said, not only do we crave a better future, we crave the end of it all. We'd like to see the end of all this dukkha. Of course. But the way we crave it is unskillful. We crave the end of pain. We crave the end of suffering. We crave the end of insecurity. It can't be reached. But there's wanting that. And it is in the very wanting that we suffer. You know, recent studies have been done and have shown that what we think will make us happy doesn't make us as happy as we think it will. And what we fear or imagine will make us unhappy doesn't make us as unhappy as we fear it will. Another study inquired of people who'd won the lottery. You know, you win the lottery, gazillions of, or millions of dollars, and you think, now I can buy my happiness. They found an interesting fact that 1 year after winning the lottery, most people were no happier than the day before they won the lottery. Yeah, they bought a lot of stuff, they paid off some debts, they took a couple holidays, but their baseline happiness wasn't changed. They also looked at people who had received a diagnosis of a terminal illness or had a catastrophic accident or some major upheaval, some major unpleasantness in their life, which we would normally think is like, wow, destroy your life, make you miserable. Again, a year after the accident or whatever, baseline happiness unchanged from where it was the day before the diagnosis or whatever. When you take these two studies together, what you come up with is we don't really know what's going to make us happy. And our idea of happiness doesn't depend on conditions. Happiness is not dependent on external conditions. It is more dependent on our state of mind. Which is helpful or hopeful or supportive of what we're doing here, taking a look at the mind. Because it's in the mind's relationship to all that's going on that we're either going to make ourselves miserable or make ourselves free. The second noble truth of craving is to be abandoned. It is the craving to be abandoned. It's not the things that we crave that need to be abandoned. It's the craving itself. It's that mental attitude of clinging, wanting, grasping, holding on to be abandoned. Now, if the Buddha had realized the two noble truths, there's dukkha caused by craving, good luck. We'd be in a fix, wouldn't we? Because what are we going to do? Is there any answer? Is there any relief? Is there any way out of this? Well, lucky for us, the Buddha went on and discovered a couple of more truths. And the third noble truth that the Buddha realized, or what the Buddha realized he articulated in the third noble truth, he said, there's an end to dukkha. Now, there is a cessation to dukkha. There's an end to dukkha. After the Buddha's enlightenment and awakening, he was blissed out. Hung around the Bodhi tree for 7 weeks, just kind of hanging out. He stood for a week looking at the tree. He sat for a week. You know, he just kind of was, you know, 49 days, just blitzed. Blissed, I mean. Blissed. And similar, but not quite the same. Anyway, and then he said, now what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And he considered going out, wandering off into the Himalayas, just kind of hanging out in some cave, just kind of happy by himself. But then he looked at all the suffering beings in the world and wondered whether there was anyone who could understand what it was he'd realized. Now, most of us might think that when he looked around and surveyed the world, he's going to say, gosh, you know, what I realize is really heavy duty. It's really pretty, complicated. It's pretty out there. I don't know if anybody can handle it. But I don't think that. I think instead, the Buddha might have said, you know, This is a really subtle and a very refined understanding of suffering and the end of suffering. And he said something to that effect. He said, you know, this, let's see. It is... Of the end of suffering, he proclaimed, it's deep, it's hard to see, it's hard to understand, it is peaceful, it is sublime, it is beyond mere reasoning, it is subtle, but it is discoverable or it's intelligible to those who are wise. Okay, so it's subtle. It's a refined understanding that the Buddha's pointing to. Often when we hear the Third Noble Truth, we hear it spoken of in terms of enlightenment, nibbana, liberation, stages of awakening, whatever, which all sound pretty remote, like maybe somewhere in the future if I'm a good yogi. But I want to speak about the Third Noble Truth in terms of what we're doing here and your experiences today. Because the end of dukkha is subtle, it can occur and we might not recognize it. So in order to support our continued practice doing what we're doing, it's important to look at our experience, look at our practice in terms of, is this dukkha, or is this the end of dukkha? So there's several ways that we can approach the understanding of the end of dukkha and see it in our practice here today. Let me give you one example. You know, when you're sitting and, you know, your mind wanders off, you know, and you get caught up in some thought, some fantasy, some memory, something, you know, and the body gets its appropriate tied up in knots about it. And then you come to, and you go, my mind's been wandering. My body's kind of tight. Do I need to be doing this right now? No. I think I'll let go. Oh, okay. You know, and because we're paying attention, we see the holding in the mind, reflected as holding in the body, and we can intentionally let go. That is letting go of this identification, letting go of this attachment, letting go of this clinging to this idea or this emotion and this physical pattern of tension. So it takes awareness to recognize the holding and intention to let go of it. That is a moment. I agree, it's only a moment, but it is a moment, we could call it a dukkha-free zone. Now, when I first started practice, everybody's got their own, you know, particular brand of mental gripping, I call it. When I first started practice, when I went to college, I studied engineering. And this was back in the days before handheld computers. It's when everything was done with slide rule and a lot of mental math. And so there was a lot of mathematics in the mind, and I just had years of doing math in the mind. So, you know, I went to a retreat, started doing my practice. When my mind would wander, my mind wandered to multiplying 4- and 5-digit numbers in my head. And I was just kind of, you know, and I'd wake up and I'd say, do I need to figure this out? I don't think so. Oh, phew, what a relief. But you know what? If I wasn't practicing mindfulness, I wouldn't have noticed it. And my mind would have been clinging and tied up in useless mathematics. And the body along with it. Now, I know you all have your own little personal discoveries of what... of what your mind is doing quite unnecessarily. But if you're not paying attention, you won't see it. That's why we're just trying to pay attention to the present moment, because then we'll see it. We'll see all these, well, stupid things, right? I mean, I'm sure you've seen some today. The mind just wandering off, getting entangled in something that you could care less about. It is not important to you. It's just a habit. And that's what's important to see, is that so much of our suffering is just an unconscious habit. So we make it conscious, and we can intentionally let go. That's one way we see the end of dukkha. There's a second way. You know those hindrances and those defilements I spoke about the other night? Well, they're operating pretty full time in our mind. And before we practice, or when our practice is weak, we're just acting them out willy-nilly, just, you know, not giving them a second thought. But when we stop and pay attention, and we begin to see how subtle aversion is, and desire is, and jealousy, and envy, and comparing mind, and judging, and oh, it's just endless, those defilements. When we see the defilements, we see how much suffering it is, how unsatisfactory it is to be locked into this mind, this defiled mind, that's chattering away and scheming and strategizing. It's just... But when we become mindful of it, what happens? Often, it just stops. Just with that utter awareness. Sometimes it lingers, often it comes back, and we see it again, and we see it again, and we get more moments of relief. In time, our ability to recognize the defilements quickly, before they take root and proliferate and really grow strong, we become so skillful at it that the hindrances or defilements don't really pull us into dukkha. The awareness, the ongoing continuity of awareness, is an ongoing relief from that dukkha. So, you know, I'm sure you've seen, even though it's only been a few days, that as you practice, you begin to catch your wandering mind quicker. You begin to catch your reactivity a little quicker. If it's quicker, that's less dukkha. There's a third way that we experience the ending of dukkha in our practice here. And we've spoken about it a little bit, but it may not be so apparent in the first few days of a retreat, but as the days go on, it becomes more apparent. And that is in the development of what are called the seven factors of awakening, in the development of energy, interest, and joy, balanced by calmness, collectedness, and non-reactivity, equanimity. When the mind, when these qualities are developed in the mind becomes more equanimous. That's the direction we're going. Equanimity is, as Kamala mentioned last night, it's resting the mind before it falls into extremes. And the extremes are the defilements. Either attachment, aversion, or apathy, defilement. So if you can rest the mind before it falls into the defilements, dukkha-free. Equanimity is being developed, cultivated, and developed with every moment of awareness. We don't see it yet. It takes an ongoing continuity of awareness to really begin to see and feel how strong the equanimity is, how strong the non-reactivity is. We're still being challenged in the first few days of retreat or first few years of practice. You know, there's still things coming up and challenging us and knocking us off balance, and so we don't feel non-reactive. But the length of our reactivity gets less, the quickness of recognizing reactivity gets quicker, and in time, with the development of stronger awareness, more continuous awareness, the equanimity gets stronger. And that equanimity inoculates the mind from dukkha. That's the direction practice takes us. There's a further way of experiencing the end of dukkha, and it is through the development of insight. Now, insight is the English word for vipassana. Vipassana means insight, it means clear seeing, but it refers to the clear seeing of three things. The clear seeing of what are called the three universal characteristics. They are anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Anicca means impermanence. It is a quality, or it's a characteristic, of all phenomena. Whatever is experienced has the characteristics of impermanence. Now, as we develop our awareness, and the continuity of our awareness becomes strong, what we begin to see in every moment is that this moment's experience is impermanent. We see it, and it's gone. We see it, and it's gone. We see it, and it's gone. It's not just in the seeing of impermanence that we get the relief. It's in the understanding that everything is impermanent that we get the relief in this way. When the understanding and the knowledge of impermanence grows in the mind, whatever appears in the mind is seen for what it is and understood to be impermanent. It's there only for a split second. When the mind develops that understanding, it will not reach for and grab onto or attach to what it knows to be impermanent. And so the mind is seeing each moment with the understanding that it's impermanent, and therefore the mind does not cling, does not crave, does not grasp. The second noble truth, we could say, craving or clinging is abandoned by the understanding that this and all things are impermanent. So the mind doesn't reach, the mind doesn't cling, the mind doesn't crave, the mind doesn't grasp. The mind is still experiencing everything in life, but it's not reaching it and grasping it because of this understanding. This understanding is not intellectual. What I'm saying is intellectual. You can understand it intellectually. But it's in the actual seeing of it that is this understanding. When the mind doesn't reach, doesn't cling, doesn't crave, doesn't grasp, it remains free, liberated, we say. The mind is liberated. This is the end of dukkha. The second noble truth of clinging is to be abandoned in order to reach the end of dukkha. So just from the understanding of impermanence, I mean the deep realization, not just understanding, it's a realization because it's experiential. There's no clinging, therefore no dukkha. We reach the end of dukkha. The second universal characteristic is also an understanding, and it's the understanding of dukkha. Now remember what I said. Dukkha is pain, it's insecurity or vulnerability, and it's oppressive. Now, when the truth of dukkha is being realized by awareness, in every moment of seeing this moment, this present moment's experience, there is the understanding. This is dukkha. It's either painful, or it's oppressive, or it's unstable and therefore incapable of providing security. This knowledge, this understanding is experiential. It's not in the head. It's experiential. And so in every moment of seeing this experience, there's the understanding. Yes, this is the experience, and it is dukkha. When you truly understand something to be painful, vulnerable, oppressive, incapable of providing security, the mind does not reach for it to rely on it. So the mind doesn't reach. The mind doesn't cling. The mind doesn't grasp. The mind doesn't attach to anything. Life goes on. The mind still experiences everything that you experience today, except dukkha. The third universal characteristic, or the third understanding to be realized through insight, is what's called the anatta characteristic. The anatta characteristic means that all experience is conditioned. It arises due to conditions. It has no inherent thingness in itself. Because this comes together with that, it gives rise to an experience. So, when the understanding of the anatta characteristic is ripe or ripening in the mind, we see each moment's experience and we understand this is just condition. It's just in the nature of things to appear this way. There's nothing there, really. It's ephemeral. It's just come together for a brief moment because conditions are right. When you understand that there really is nothing there other than just a momentary conjunction of conditions, the mind is not going to reach for it. It's like a rainbow. You know, a rainbow appears in the sky due to a conjunction of moisture, sunlight, and viewing it from the right angle. If those conditions are there, rainbow appears. Nobody reaches to grab that rainbow because we know it's not really substantial. There's really nothing there. It's an appearance due to conditions without any inherent substance. Well, the anatta characteristic is like that. When it is ripening in the mind, we understand that everything that's experienced is like a rainbow. It appears in the mind due to a conjunction of conditions, but it has no inherent substance to be grasped and relied on. It's just an appearance. And so when we understand that, the mind doesn't reach for it. It doesn't grasp it. It doesn't cling it. It doesn't want it, yearn for it. It just sees there's an appearance. Great. And the mind remains liberated, free from clinging. Let's go, the second noble truth of clinging is abandoned through the understanding of the anatta characteristic. Now, what is so special about these three characteristics is in each moment of truly realizing impermanence, dukkha, or the conditionality, the mind is free. The mind doesn't reach, the mind is free. It's the end of dukkha. More importantly, and this is really what the Buddha was ultimately pointing to in the Third Noble Truth. When the mind doesn't reach to grasp anything, whether it's for a period of time or just really lets go, the mind can access the unconditioned. The unconditioned is nibbana. Nibbana is the end of dukkha. It's possible. The mind falls into, if you will, or it reaches the end of the known. It sees there's nothing there to grasp. And the mind is liberated. It is an understanding. It's not an experience. It's not something that you can describe, that you can talk about, that has any size, shape, color, texture, time. However, it can be realized. It's an understanding to be realized. that the mind is liberated through the unconditioned. These are the many ways that we experience here and that our practice will bring us to realize as we continue our practice, the end of dukkha. So the third noble truth is not remote. It's not far away. It's not for a future life, a next retreat, or when you finally become whatever. It's even now. In any sitting, we can experience moments of this liberated mind, this mind free of dukkha. It's not accidental. The Buddha said and articulated in the fourth noble truth that there is a path to be developed in order to realize this third noble truth. Importantly, each person must realize the end of dukkha for themselves. It can't be given to you. You can't buy it, you can't acquire it any other way except to realize it for yourself. And the way to realize it, the Buddha said, is to develop what's called the fourth noble truth or the noble eightfold path. The noble eightfold path is, you know, right view, right thought, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, right action, right speech, right livelihood. Okay? But essentially, these eight factors to be developed are three trainings. It's a training in sila or morality, purifying your speech and behavior, which we are doing here by living according to the precepts. It is purifying your mind through developing right energy, right mindfulness, right concentration, which we are doing here by developing moment-to-moment awareness, right mindfulness, right concentration. And it's through developing right understanding or purifying your understanding to develop right view and right thought, which is what we are doing here as we begin to see that everything arises and passes away. So what we're doing here in every moment of our attempt to be mindful is fulfilling the three trainings of the Noble Eightfold Path. If you develop the causes, the effect of the realization of the end of dukkha will happen. What we're doing in every moment of trying to be mindful is practicing the three trainings of the Noble Eightfold Path. When they become perfected, or to the extent that we develop them, we will realize the third noble truth, the end of dukkha, because we will be abandoning craving, the second noble truth, and its result, dukkha, the first noble truth. All of our efforts here is the most you can do in any one moment for realizing the end of suffering. Anyone who has freed their mind from suffering has done it this way, has included these practices, these understanding. So let's sit for a moment and let the words quiet down. The third Zen patriarch in the verses on the faith mind put it this way. The great way is not difficult for those who are not attached to their preferences. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinion for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is a disease of the mind. And when the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail.